This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
It was a mixed week on Wall Street this week. Blue chip stocks having a good week, still in positive territory, but tech stocks really taking a beating on Friday. All of that despite some of the best numbers on GDP that we've had in almost 10 years, with the economy reporting a growth rate for the second quarter of 4.1%. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava. Welcome to a special edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Joining me in hour one will be Robin Griffith. He's got a saying you might want to listen to. He says, only the strong will survive. He believes the only place to be right now if you're in financial markets is in the U.S. And he says, look out for those FANG stocks. Sooner or later, they're going to come tumbling down. That interview was done on Thursday, and a lot of those tech stocks came tumbling down on Friday. He has some favorite areas, and he also has some prognostications about what he thinks could happen after 2020. So you're going to want to hear what Robin has to say. Frank Holmes will be joining me later on in the program as we talk about peak gold, few discoveries, and the importance of common law when it comes to mining rights today. There's very few discoveries being made. And unlike the oil industry that experienced technological innovation, it really hasn't come to the mining industry that could increase gold extraction for the companies the way shale oil did for the oil companies. And he believes the price of gold could actually be suppressed. And of course, Chris Sheridan will be here to talk about what moved the markets this week. All of that coming up in a special edition of the Financial Sense News Hour.
And I'm John Loeffler. You know, we've been doing this program for about 18 years now, and sometimes looking back at the past is a good way of helping you understand the future. We're going to go all the way back to the tech bubble of the 1990s, when the federal funds rate dropped down to 1% and then down to zero, through the second Gulf War, preparedness issues with Hurricanes Katrina and Rita, then the real estate bubble and the lessons we can learn from that, of course, going through the Great Recession and the Great Recovery. And then into some really strange territory. All of that coming up today on The Big Picture as part of the Financial Sense News Hour. And as we always do at the first part of the program every single week, time for the market wrap. And this week, Chris Sheridan is standing in for Ryan Poplava. Chris.
The markets were certainly mixed this week. The Dow ended up 1.6%, the S&P rose 0.6%, but the Nasdaq was down over 1%. Both the Dow and the S&P 500 posted their fourth straight weekly gains, the longest such streak since January. U.S. GDP for the second quarter came in at a whopping 4.1%. That's the highest quarterly jump in nearly 4 years and the third best pace of growth since the Great Recession. Speaking on Friday, Trump said that as the trade deals come in, quote, we are going to go a lot higher than these numbers, end quote. And though a higher pace of economic growth would certainly be welcome for many of us, our Financial Sense leading economic indicator is currently projecting growth to soften in the third quarter. On this point, Bloomberg's chief U.S. economist Carl Riccadonna writes, to be sure, there is evidence that tax reforms and cuts are helping to stimulate activity, but the performance of consumer spending in the second quarter is unlikely to carry through in full force into the second half of the year. As a result, the overall pace of growth will moderate, and Bloomberg Economics is maintaining its forecast for 2.8% in the second half. Consumers are benefiting from tax cuts and a tighter labor market, but household income creation has not yet accelerated to a pace that can support 4% growth on a sustained basis. That being said, the recent GDP report does solidify the case for two more Fed rate hikes this year. Our own Fed Funds Risk Neutral Index shows Fed monetary policy is still relatively loose when you compare where the Fed funds rate is compared to economic growth rates and current inflation rates. We will continue to provide updates on this indicator going forward, but from our vantage point, it is still premature to say that the Fed is leaning against the economy with really any force. That story may change, however, in 2019. This week was a total wreck for social media. Both Facebook and Twitter got whacked hard, with the stocks of both companies down around 20% after reports on slowing user growth and weaker guidance. Facebook in particular suffered the largest one-day drop in market value of any company in U.S. stock market history. So that's pretty big news right there. And according to some reports, Zuckerberg, Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO and founder of Facebook, he reportedly lost around $15 billion just from the big decline in Facebook this week. Another item that gained attention was the U.S. housing market. Many headlines are now proclaiming the possibility of a broad slowdown. So recent data from CoreLogic and Redfin showed problems in a number of key areas, with CNBC noting a crash in Southern California home sales. That has typically been a warning sign, or maybe a warning sign, for the rest of the nation. Next week, we're actually going to be doing a special on the U.S. housing market, and we're going to be looking at this from nearly every angle you can imagine: housing affordability, home prices, Fed rate increases, the 30-year, you name it, all of the variables and factors that do affect the housing market. So be sure to tune in then.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour, featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
That has political ramifications, and the Fed doesn't want to go there, which is absurd. But that's the position that the Republicans in the House and Senate have put the central bank in, by pretending that they can steal money from the Fed to pay for highway legislation. I mean, it's that bad. It's a third world situation on Capitol Hill right now when it comes to fiscal matters.
Well, the best thing you can say about this summer rally, the markets are back into positive territory. We've seen rallies from international stocks to blue chips to small cap stocks. The question is, will they take out those January highs as some of the indexes do, or will this be another failed attempt? Joining me on the program is Robin Griffith. And Robin, last time we had you on the program, you were in the bullish side. You thought stocks would head higher. Here we are. Most of the indexes, I would say all of them, are into positive territory, especially small caps and the technology sector. Do you still hold those views?
Well, yes, but it's important to say that you have to be in the USA. The latest little piece I've just finished writing is called Only the Strong Survive. And at the moment, the strong one is the USA. There's a lovely quote from 1903 saying, "This is the law of the Yukon, that only the strong will thrive. Surely the weak will die, and only the fit survive." I look at 40 different world markets. And back in the beginning of January, when we were having a globally coordinated bull market, 40 different markets were making patterns of rising highs and lows above rising 200-day moving averages. Right now, we have 39% only above a rising 200-day moving average. So the correction, and we were overdue for certainly a 10% correction in most markets, which is normal, and we were overdue for it. But the fact is, it's dropped a lot of the weaker brethren right off the bottom of the scale, and they're in a bear market now. Any market that can't put up with rising inflation, rising interest rates, and a strong dollar gets punished. And courtesy of the president's very aggressive negotiating stance, which may or may not turn into a trade war, anyone that relies on world trade, their markets got a bit beaten up. So on my methodology, bearing in mind the world market is dominated by the big markets, the world market is still in a bull market, but incredibly few markets are beating it. And the one that is the US of A, basically, partly because the dollar is so strong. The other markets like China and, well, particularly India, are slightly less strong. China, of course, is the other side of the trade war and has been matching tariff barriers by allowing the yuan to drop dramatically to counteract the effect. In my opinion, though, we may not actually be going to have a trade war. We're having a negotiation, and the very dominant alpha males always negotiate in a certain way. They begin with an extreme position of everything they won't agree with, and then they slowly come into a more middle ground and sit down and strike a deal. And the man is good at doing the deal. So in my opinion, we're not going to have military wars with North Korea or Russia. We're going to play golf with those guys, but we're going to do a deal. And the same with this so-called world trade war. We're going to actually have deals. It is certainly true that China has been effectively dumping cheap goods on America for years, but it isn't totally one-sided. Basically, America grows an awful lot of food, and at the moment, there aren't that many buyers for it. They need a buyer. And China needs to buy a lot of soya beans, corn, and wheat. And if it did so, the trade balance between the two nations would balance up really quite neatly. And Donald could say at the halftime elections, there you are, I've achieved something. And Mr. Xi could say, there you are, I've bought some good food, we need to eat this. Incidentally, General Motors already sells far more cars in China than it does in the USA or anywhere else in the world. So the trade balance isn't quite as lopsided as we've been told, but it is lopsided, and I think quite rightly, the president just wants to address the balance and move a bit in the correct direction. The same with his talks with Mr. Juncker. Lots of Americans want to buy BMWs and Mercedes, and jolly good luck, but they're not going to get screwed in the process. So, you know, we need to negotiate this, and I think the terms will be better. And he's absolutely in his rights to tell those other countries, you're not paying your fair share of NATO. You're letting us defend you, and you're only coming up with peanuts on your side of the table. So either get ready to spend some more money or, you know, one way or another, we've got to address this. So I'm actually with him all the way on this. I mean, many people think he's mad, but there is definitely method in his madness. And I think what we're actually doing is negotiating. We're not having a trade war. And that, of course, is in the market prices. The market knows this. When we come to the American markets, though, one of the things that is of concern is this word fragility in the way that Nicholas Taleb would use it. If too much of the performance comes down to a small bank of stocks called FANG, it is fragile. And it is quite true that some of the big indices, if you strip FANG from them, they're not going anywhere special. They're not necessarily very weak, but they're not going up. And then, of course, we do see some of the FANG stocks at least wobbling a bit. Facebook, we know that Tesla's been hemorrhaging cash and, you know, all those sort of problems. So I think that the period of time when the particular group of FANG stocks is all you needed to own, and then you can play golf every day, that era is coming to an end, even though not all the FANG stocks are coming to an end. I'm sure I would have thought Google, Microsoft, Amazon, you know, they're going to be up there for a long while. What they won't necessarily do is stay on very highly inflated PE ratios for a long time. But we've got a bunch of indicators that we use to say, are we in trouble or not? And the Conference Board of the US has got an extremely good early indicator with a great track record. And looking at that and the Conference Board's indicator now, the notion that we're about to have a recession at any stage in the next 12 months, it doesn't fly. Even in the next 18 months, it'd be pretty unlikely. So the economy doesn't turn down for at least 12, maybe 18 months. Of course, the stock market can discount earlier than that. And as a rough heuristic rule, it looks 6 months in front. Occasionally, it looks further or less than that. But on average, 6 months in front of the real world is how the stock market. So my opinion is, and what my indicators are saying at the moment, is that the U.S. economy, it's like a supertanker. You can talk a trade war, and that won't stop the thing moving straight away. It takes a long time. We're going to carry on higher for longer, probably to the end of this year. Once we get into 2019, it things start getting choppy. And I think once we get near the end of 2019, whatever happens, the economy will cool down and we will get a bear market. But at the moment, all of my indicators are saying stay with the strong markets. So staying with the passive holding of the global index, stay with the USA. I mean, looking at the economic numbers, the USA is growing at something like 4.5% per annum now. China, even in its cooled down, addressing the credit bubble state, is growing at about 6%. And India is growing at 7.7%. So the big economies on the planet, they're doing okay. They can absorb some bad news now. Even when I look at the classic signal for a bear market, the inverting yield curve, what you've got is a flattened yield curve. It doesn't matter whether you look at the 2s to 10s or the 5s to 30s, but the ratio between them is flattened off. But both ratios can slide up the chart. You don't have to actually get the inverted yield curve yet. I, in my work, have actually got a composite set of leading indicators. There's 11 of them, and I normally plot them on a spider chart. It's rather like a clock face. And when the indicators are all out around the edge of the clock, the spider web spread out, you're not in trouble. And, of course, as it comes into the middle with a broken spider web, you're in trouble. And when I compare where the spider web is now to where it was in 2007-08 when we did have a top, we're nowhere near there. Roughly 20% of the 11 indicators have already turned down. So it's not all good, but it isn't bad enough to be bad yet. I mean, typically, on my particular indicator, I've tweaked the numbers so that you have to have half of them, 50%, turned down before you get a sell signal in a bear market. So 20%, it's a heads up. Things aren't as great as they were until we hit January, but they're not that bad. So on balance, stay with the bull market. There's another way of looking at it, which is I also, when I rank technically all of the assets in the world, I put gold in inverse equities and cash and government bonds in the list. They're all down the bottom of the list. Now, if we really were about to go into a major equity bear market, all of those would have come floating up the list, and they would be near the top. And they're not. They're spectacularly not. The only one of the, what you might call, fear assets, which is good, is the U.S. dollar. In fact, for a U.S. citizen, being cautious and sitting on cash, you're definitely not punished for that. Whereas if you sit on cash in pounds or euros or yen, you're getting clobbered. So if you're going to hold some cash, make sure it's the U.S. dollar. That's what one of the things that my work produces quite clearly. And at the moment, although gold isn't terribly ghastly, it's not great. It doesn't come high in the list of assets you need to hold. The reason why you might hold some is because it's a risk diversifier. And looking into the future, which is very hard to do, we will be moving into an era when the rupee and the renminbi or yuan become more important. And in both of those cultures, they love gold. But just at the moment, as in the now, as it were, my work says you don't need gold. You're better to own the dollar than gold. And you better own some equities as long as you're in the strong markets. There's one rather weird one, which is India. Because India doesn't really do a lot of world trade, it has not been punished by the potential trade war. And perversely, the trade war has dropped the price of oil by about 8%. And India imports oil, so it's suddenly better off. And what that has done is very briefly put the Indian market right back up into the very top of the list. But, of course, if the price of oil rallies again, and I suggest there's quite a good chance of that happening, then that same rally would drop India back down. It won't be very weak, but it wouldn't be as strong as the US or the global index. From a very, very long-term point of view, India is my preferred long-term lock-up investment, because when you look at the figures coming from giant accounting firms who audit the books of companies all over the world, they're in a very good position to tell you how the world might look in 2030 and 2050. And it doesn't matter whether it's Pete Marwick or Kidder Peabody or any of these other ones, they're all coming to the conclusion that in about 2030 or later, the largest economy is definitely going to be China. And number two will be India. And certainly by 2050, if not 2030, America will have grown. It will have a bigger economy than it's currently got, but will have been outgrown by Asia. So it'll come in at number three, and then number four is Japan. And talking about Europe, the only two European economies hanging in the top 10 will be Germany at about number seven, and Britain just holding on by its fingernails at number 10. Nothing else in Europe is going to be in the top 10 economies in the future. In my opinion, the European experiment, it's a basket case, frankly. And the sooner we get out of it, the better, or one way or another. Just those economies are just simply not growing. Europe is a bunch of rules about what you're not allowed to do and how you're not allowed to make money. And if you do, you will be regulated and taxed into oblivion. So businesses are far better doing business with Asia than mucking around in expensive Europe, basically. So I am still an equity bull, but not a great one.
Let me interrupt you with two questions here. We talked about trade, and that's created some turbulence in the market. And as we saw this week, it's been more of a negotiating tool used by this president, and it's working. Europe came over, and there were concessions made. So it is likely, I think you would agree, that this is going to happen with China. If that does happen, could this be the catalyst that moves the market forward into higher levels at the end of the year? Because the S&P hasn't taken out its January high. Only the Russell 2000 and the NASDAQ has done that. So that's my first question. My second question, when you look at the S&P, you made reference to it. You're talking about a handful of stocks that account for the majority of the index. So how risky is that when you're basing an index on the movement of a handful of stocks? If you could answer those two, I would appreciate it.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with where you're coming from. And the first answer is, yes, I do think the S&P by the end of the year will follow the other indices for these reasons. Things aren't as good as they were, but it's still better than in many other markets in the world, really. We know, going back to the dear old Dow, that even General Electric, the last remaining member of the original constituents, has now been kicked out of it again. So, you know, the Dow isn't what we're looking at. That's not corporate America. The S&P moving into the NASDAQ is much nearer it. And I think that the fangs that remain strong will be able to do this. But, and again, referring to Nicholas Taleb's latest book, Fragility, it is very, very risky when everybody's been herded into the few great stocks. And of course, they will eventually get to a point where there's no one left to buy them, and equally no one to whom you could sell in size. And at some point, therefore, that's going to lead to an absolutely massive correction. Because if you were only coming down from, say, 40 times earnings back to 20, we can live with that. Well, when some of these stocks are coming off 300 times earnings, well, the setback there, I mean, the growth is never going to do it for you. It will be the share price that does most of the correction. There can be a pretty massive reset. And of course, what will happen is the fall in the stock market when we get to that stage will cause people to want money back in the bank. And then the debt mountain, the bubble numbers, will become very much what we all know they're there. What is the global debt? Something like $253 trillion now. Nobody can pay that back. But at the moment we say, yeah, but stocks are going up, stay bullish. But there'll come a time when we won't dismiss it like that. The debt will be the thing that produces, either at the best, it will be an extended period of incredibly modest returns to investment. And at the worst, of course, it would be the mother and father of a bear market. It's entirely possible that what we've watched Japan go through for the last 30 years, the Western world may have to do the same. Nobody, you know, died of starvation or anything in Japan, but we've had a 25-year bear market and now a little bit of a bull market. And we're a long, long, long way from being back up anywhere near the high. And it's just taken half a generation to do that. The debt mountain is big enough to put us into that sort of situation. And in some industries, more like depressionary conditions. I mean, right now, if you're a farmer and the Chinese aren't buying your crop off you, you need a handout from the government. So that's a bit like the depressionary situation. So, I mean, hopefully it won't get as bad as that. But at some point, it's got to get pretty nasty. And my timing models suggest that we can get through into 2019. I think it will get bumpy in 2019, or volatile, to put it better. And then after that, 2020 onwards through 2023, it's likely to be a time to be very risk averse and have had your into lots of different places, so that no one of them can bother you too hard. I've got a concept which I've always used called the volatility signature. And what it is, we measure in a normal year, any given asset class, how much does the price just swing around on volatility? And it's quite, what I normally do is I measure the high and the low of the swing, plus the average over a period of years. So this is relevant to the price of oil right now. If you look historically at oil, it regularly swings between 10 and 16%. So when you have a setback, as we just have, of about 8%, doesn't mean anything. Mere random volatility can do that. It is not a change in the trend of the asset. And the trend direction is upwards. So I think once the trade war is seen to have been a negotiation which settles down with a deal, the price of energy, oil and gas, will go back up again. And that uptrend will resume. And another thing I've got is, there is a relationship, especially in the U.S., between the rate of interest and the volatility of the stock market. If you take this back many years and look, every time the Fed hikes, what happens to volatility in the equity market? And there is, rising interest rate program that the Fed has now got and is probably correct to have, will tend to drive rising volatility rather than changes in trend in the equity market. And because we've come from a period of exceptionally low volatility, almost no volatility, it's going to seem to people who've settled down with the last couple of years as, my God, the volatility's gone mad. But it doesn't seem to be a change of trend. It's just making a fool out of us every day kind of thing. So, and I'm expecting that to be probably a feature from late this year all through 2019, basically. Big increase in the VIX and volatility in equity markets. And because the equity market in America is so big, you'll find one sector's already had a bear market, another sector's still in the old bull market, something else is just becoming volatile. And it may not make sense to talk about it as though it's one single homogeneous entity anymore. You'll get different sectors behaving differently. But if this thought process is correct, moving some of your money into those asset classes which have traditionally not been nearly as volatile might make a lot of sense. You'll sleep at night rather better. So they may sound boring, things like utilities and some REITs. They sound a bit boring, but they're much less volatile than some of these other things. And I think cautiously moving in that direction will make a lot of sense. I don't think it will maximize your profit potential, but it will make a lot of sense.
Listen, Robin, as we close, if our listeners like to follow all the great work you do, how could they do so?
Well, I've got two newsletters, one mainly aimed for institutions, is the ECU Group, ecu.com. That is called Global Investment Roadmap. There's also a new newsletter coming out with one of Bill Bonner's companies, the Agora Press. The UK business of that is called South Bank Research, and they publish my new newsletter, which is called Dynamic Trend Alert. The first edition went out last month. I've literally just finished writing the second, which is called Only the Strong Survive, so you get the theme from it. But you can go onto their website and get that. I hope people find it enjoyable.
Well, listen, Robin, as always, thanks for joining us on the program. Great insights, and we look forward to talking to you again.
Yeah, indeed. Thank you very much.
Should you buy and hold at a market top? At Financial Sense Wealth Management, we believe valuations, leading economic indicators, and other metrics are essential for prudent investing to both identify long-term opportunities and minimize risk. Every day, we keep a watchful eye on the markets, continually assessing the investment landscape so you can focus on the things you love most. Don't put your hard-earned wealth at risk.
Give us a call at Financial Sense Advisors. Call toll-free 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. 3939. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities Incorporated, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense NewsHour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
Amazon is preparing for some form of civil unrest if we do not see a deal between the UK and the EU before that March 29th deadline, as you said.
There would probably be controls at borders, at ports. There could be like long queues for trucks and for ships trying to transport goods from one place to another. The financial sector in the UK would lose their passporting rights, according to which they can sell their products to countries in the single market. There would be lots of uncertainty about the future of British citizens in Europe and European citizens in the UK. So definitely a messy situation, lots of uncertainty, lots of chaos. But I still think that even if we get to the point when there is not a deal by March 2019, the EU and the UK would still be interested in keeping the negotiation alive to reach an agreement at some point in the future.
Well, for gold investors, it looked like it might have been promising at the beginning of the year, but it's almost been straight down since then as gold hits bottoms we haven't seen since last summer. Joining me on the program from U.S. Global is Frank Holmes. Frank, let's talk about the current state of the gold market. As I look at a chart of gold, you know, we're pretty close to the bottoms that we hit in July of last year. I don't know how much further this goes or when this turns around, but let's talk about the state of the gold market as it exists right now.
I think that we're really oversold. And to me, let's jump back up at 50,000 feet. You know what really surprises me is how well gold is holding up in U.S. dollars in light when you compare real interest rates. And that is the two-year government bonds is where a lot of currency relative evaluations are made around the yields and real interest rates. And there are very few countries with real interest rates. And if you take a look at the mega debt that's out there with negative interest rates, we're talking about Japan with $5 trillion. And they basically have 10 basis points as the cost of money. And you would just think that the same thing with Europe, with Germany has $732 billion of debt that's at negative real interest rates. So I think that whenever I've seen such a spread of that the two-year government bond yield of the U.S. is so much greater than all the other countries in the world, that usually the dollar is much stronger and gold is much weaker. So from in that context, gold is actually holding up in U.S. dollars exceptionally well. Now, when we look at what we call the standard deviation moves, the rolling 60-day trading, is it overbought and oversold? And our math goes back 30 years, and we like to do this rolling 10 years and rolling 5 years, but to us, it's these sort of snapshot time periods. And one of the things that's really important for the listeners is that whenever the dollar is up one standard deviation, that means 70% of the time it can move this amount and what percentage move that is. Whenever it's up one standard deviation, there's a 35% probability the dollar is going to correct. But whenever gold is down one standard deviation, there's a 60% probability gold's going to rally. And right now we have gold stocks and gold off two standard deviations. And that suggests that we have close to a 75% probability over the next 60 trading days, gold will rally from these price levels. So I think Sergeant Friday used to say from Dragnet, nothing but the facts, ma'am. And we like to apply this sort of card counting approach towards the gold market when it acts so sloppy.
Frank, when you talk about this probability and it and the fact that it's oversold, certainly it's almost close to the bottoms. If you take a look at other asset classes, and as you said, the interest rates have been rising, but in much of the world, if you look at Europe and Japan, the rates are still negative. So, you know, it doesn't seem like interest rates are providing that much of a competition. Certainly, if interest rates are a little over 2% here, that certainly isn't much. I mean, gold can go up 2% in an hour, so that wouldn't take much there. If you look at this, other than seasonality, What's going to be the catalyst? I mean, right now, things are going well in the U.S. We're supposed to get a GDP print tomorrow that could be 4%. You know, the stock market isn't doing great other than the FANG stocks. But what's going to be the catalyst that's going to drive it?
I think it's going to be something with the dollar. And I think that that's the big factor, is something's going to happen with the dollar. And we still have the love trade remain strong. This whole thing of rising GDP per capita in China, friends of mine, and we just came back from Sicily, vice chairman, he said it was packed with Chinese tourists. Same thing in Rome. Everywhere in Europe, it's all Chinese tourists. And I've written about this before, that the rise of the middle class is so significant in China, even though it gets lost in a sea of 1.4 billion, there are more middle class than there are in America, just because of population. And they're traveling, and they buy more gold. And they're very highly correlated to the love trade. So I think that that's going to continue. And I think the other part is, it's a slow motion model, but the peak gold is a real thesis. There's been no technological breakthrough like you had for the oil industry. We did have peak oil until the frackers came along. And we're not witnessing anything that's going to be able to be of a significance to get the cost for mining down. And so therefore it becomes more and more dear. There's been very few 3 million ounce discoveries, and any major discoveries are in high risk areas that are never going to get developed. So we're not seeing the supply come out in the marketplace. And as we go through each month of data and each quarter of mining companies printing their results, we're going to see the supply from mines dropping.
You know, Frank, you bring up something, you know, if we go back to the last decade, thoughts about peak oil were out there, and then all of a sudden we discovered horizontal drilling, fracking, and all of a sudden oil production has grown. What is it about the mining industry? You know, certainly the way you mine for gold today is certainly a lot more advanced the way we did it 100 years ago. But why, in your opinion, has there not been any technological breakthroughs? Or is that just, you know, we live in a world of technology, we just assume that technology will find a way?
I think that the only person so far that can see through rock well, but he has difficulty with lead, is Superman. And I'm being facetious there. But looking at hard rock where you find this gold versus sedimentary rock, which is much softer, looking for oil or water, etc., and the costs for drilling are very different. And so I think that it just doesn't lend itself for the technology. Now, where the improvements have come from is when you get a mine into production, and that's robotics, where you can go deep underground where it's very hot and you don't have to worry about a lot of technologies helped in the mining processes. But the exploring, and there is still no massive regime change in regulations around the world. When you talk to some of these CEOs of gold mining companies, they'll tell you that they're more of a welfare company now. Otherwise, the locals protest, they kidnap. In Mexico, we just had some other tragedy. You have it, the expectations, because these countries are so corrupt, and the government, that any of their tax dollars never go back to really help with clean water, clean air in the community. And they have lots of problems when they have rich deposits, like in Colombia, of illegal workers coming in, and that's where they're using mercury or cyanide. It's all illegal, but you can't touch these people. It makes it very, very difficult. And so these mining companies end up having to spend so much of their money in social programs because the governments are inept. In fact, a couple of years back, Mexico came up with an increased tax on mining because they wanted to give that money to politicians for them to spend money in the local community, because they recognized that people were trusting American and Canadian mining companies more than they were trusting their politicians that money would come back into the community. So I think that a lot of these areas where you have the potential, like in Colombia, that it'll be very hard to bring a project on time, expand operation, because the communities play such a significant role. And also, you find that the green movement gets in there, and the green movement comes in, and they really don't care about any community service. They don't care about any economic development. They're just anti-mining, period. So these projects aren't going to get developed. So the thought process that peak supply in gold is there from exploration, there's been no technological breakthroughs, and B, there's been no real significant change where you've had a discovery to bring it on stream. It's a very, very expensive, and the timelines are very skeptical, so people don't want to put money up. I don't want to invest in these companies that all of a sudden I have to wake up one day that they're going to have force majeure on their asset, and it's too volatile for us to make that investment. So the cost of capital is extremely expensive for these companies. So I think we're going to see peak supply in gold, and the GDP per capita for India continues to rise, and that's highly correlated with that love trade. And then we're going to get these short-term swings on negative real interest rates. But I think stay long in this space. You know, the 10% golden rule we articulate is so important, and people are so forgetful that last year gold was off the sloppy at the beginning, and then it ended up being up 13% for the year. And since this beginning of this century, gold has outperformed the S&P 2-1. So having that 10% weighting is just really prudent. But I think another disruption coming along is this company called Mene, M-E-N-E, and I highly recommend anyone wants to buy gold jewelry. This is just like buying in India, where you buy, or China, 24-karat gold jewelry, very simple jewelry, at only a 10% markup, and they'll buy it back from you at a 10% discount to the price of gold. So you always have liquidity, but if you go on Fifth Avenue, you're paying a 500% markup for that gold. Here it's a 10% markup. And they tell me that they started and they can't keep up with production. They've had a triple production. It's sold like Amazon. It gets delivered in the mail to you. $100 gifts are under $100, 24-karat gold jewelry designed by Picasso's granddaughter. It's a major home run. So I think we could see things like that really pick up the love trade demand in North America.
Frank, what about the situation? How much does environmentalism play in this? Because I know today, even if you were to make a discovery, I know here in the United States, whether it's California or even Nevada, it could take 10 years to bring a mine in production. So how much of this, and you have NGOs operating overseas, how much of this is preventing the development of bringing new mines on stream?
Well, it's huge. It's huge. What used to be a 10-year program for financing from day of exploration and discovery to date of production was under 10 years. It's now pushing 20 to 30 years.
So, you know, 20, 30 years, it's happened with the energy industry, but the energy industry has been a lot more successful, at least politically, because of jobs. And plus the fact, Frank, you and I drive cars and we want to get someplace. We have to get on an airplane, which uses jet fuel. And if we want to transport goods across the ocean, it's going to take a ship with diesel fuel. So what is it about the gold industry that seems to raise the ire of the environmentalists more so than energy?
Just like the number one grossing movie, Avatar, you know, it's anti-mining. It's something that's been embedded into the system, and it'll take a while till it gets removed. There's a massive disconnect. People get to these places in their cars and airplanes, and they need petroleum, and they need mining. They need cars and jets. Everything's made out of metal. And there's this massive disconnect that you need the metal. But I think that one of the things that's really important is common law. And to me, it's most fascinating that if you go back to Cuba and Singapore, basically it was a robust country economically, Havana was, and if you compare it today to Singapore, they both basically, one went socialism, communism, and the other one went free markets, and the economic prosperity is spectacular. Singapore is quasi-common law, same thing with Hong Kong, with a low flat tax. And that sort of concept is very important here in America and Canada. Why is that? Because you have property rights. Property rights are very significant for the creation of Uber. It's my car. That would never happen to be created, that concept, technological breakthrough, in a country with civil law. And so when we go to these countries in Latin America and Central America and Africa, the majority of them are civil law countries. And the mineral rights are therefore owned by the government. The technological breakthroughs in the energy space is when people own their land. It's my land, and I'm going to protect it. You know, quite often, most of these guys have animals running around their own land. They have their own herds of cattle or rare animals, as I see in South Texas. So they don't want to make sure there's no pollution. But it's their land, and they'll spend the money to be more innovative. And I think that that's what's for investors to recognize. Wherever there's common law, it just gives a higher probability of success of free markets and capitalism. And I know that Franco-Nevada will not go and do a direct royalty into a civil law country. They usually go through a Canadian company, which then owns the rights to that land, because it's much better to be able to dispute that. And we saw this with Argentina, with bonds being, the other government was being sued, and they lost in New York on the bond issue because it's under common law. So I think we're in a very interesting spot. So what does that mean? It means that the big opportunities for gold deposits, the mine deposits, are in a lot of countries where there's civil law. And that civil law means that the mineral rights are owned by the government. And between that getting to the company, there's just so much friction, so much difficulty. And then you layer on that corruption, that a bureaucracy that they have. And then you have the environmentalists coming in that just don't want any mining. They get layered on top of that. That's why those projects aren't going to come on stream readily.
So, Frank, you know, if you take the last decade where we saw the price of oil go from almost $20 a barrel all the way up to $150, demand was growing globally as economies industrialized like China and India that drove demand in which supply could not keep up. And, of course, we had the theories of peak oil. When does something like this similar catch up with gold if we are indeed at peak gold?
It just takes time. I share with you, if you're in the investment world, like my, say, investments, and you go out to get a pension fund that's going to put money with your funds, they're all going to look at minimum your three-year number, and they're going to compare that to your five- and your 10-year number. And if your one-year number is above the three-year number, then they're more interested in looking at you. So it takes 12 quarters. So you have to have this peak goal process probably take about 12 quarters. And each quarter that you see the supply of gold from mines dropping and dropping, then more and more people will all of a sudden wake up and believe it. And then you get a sea change.
But until then, you're going to have some catalyst that drives demand, like rising prosperity in China drove the demand for gold as it did in India. And I suspect that hasn't changed much. They are more prone to invest in gold, at least in India and China, and trust that more than they do the financial markets. So is it going to mainly come from countries like India and, let's say, China that are going to drive this? Or does it eventually hit the Western world?
I think that the disruption like Amazon has been, I think this company I told you about earlier, Mene.com, I think that this can be disruptive, that it can change the pattern where we get the wealthiest country in the world, America, more and more people buying 24-karat gold and platinum gifts because the markup is very little, and that creates a brand new demand.
And what about traditional gold accumulation? It used to be, at least in the last decade, as gold was rising, you saw a tremendous demand for coins like American Eagles, Maple Leafs, etc. Do you see that coming back?
I do, but you have to have real strong momentum in gold. You have to have this momentum where you're seeing it make new highs, and it's not made three-year highs. And we'd have to get something of that nature. To me, it's most interesting, your listeners, is these institutions that I talk to and friends, they all say they don't follow technical analysis. But I found them all very similar. That is, the 50-day moving average. So if the price of gold is above the 50-day, they're more confident. If it's below, they're more bearish. And we can see fund flows into ETFs and fund flows into bullion, whatever, on the 50-day moving average. But what I share with your listeners, which is really interesting, and so there's two parts to this that are really interesting, is gold being suppressed. And I wrote about that. And there's been lots of litigation, and stuff has come out from a court system, and you've seen that UBS and other people have had to settle, Deutsche Bank, etc., of manipulating and spoofing the gold market, especially when there's a Chinese holiday. They come in and manipulate and hit the futures market down where gold could be leveraged 20 to 1. The reason why I bring that up is because historically, the total debt of America, gold is correlated, you know, rising with that total debt level. And for the past several years now, it seems to have gone sideways, whereas the debt level continues to grow. And that's really unusual. And it begs, you know, is gold being suppressed? And there is a thought process that the G20 countries' finance ministers meet independent of the leaders of the countries on a regular basis. And since 2008, they've been consumed with synchronized tax and regulation. So if they're printing all this money of negative interest rates, the last thing they want to see is gold take off because it would show the fallacy of what they're doing. And a lot of really intelligent people believe that the price of gold is being suppressed by that. So I think it's something that we have to consider. How long they'll be able to do it, I don't know. But when it surges, it will surge spectacularly. But I think the more important thing is short term for people to look at is that money's been leaving the GLD since it broke below the 50-day. And if they're really bearish, on gold, it goes to cash. And what we're seeing is money is going into the GDX and GDXJ, the ETFs. And even though we launched an ETF a year ago, and it far outperforms the GDX and GDXJ in its first year of debut, and we showed from backtesting the models, this is what it was suggested would do, and it's done exactly that, playing an intelligent way of looking at it. But what you're seeing is that big fund flows have gone into gold stocks. And I think that, to me, that historically means that there's a higher probability of gold rising over the next 60 trading days.
Well, listen, Frank, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow the work that you guys do at U.S. Global, you not only manage a gold fund, but you do, among other things, bonds and stocks. How can they find out more about your company?
USFunds.com, USFunds.com, and look to subscribe to the Investor Alert and Frank Talk and my global travels and meeting interesting CEOs and entrepreneurs and innovators. I write about those. I have about 40,000 readers in 180 countries, so they can turn around and enjoy. It's succinct but comprehensive on each of the different asset classes, from short-term tax-free bonds to China fund to Eastern Europe and to gold and resources.
Coming up next, we're going to take a look back over the last 18 years that we've been doing this program, all the way from the tech bubble explosion and then bursting through the crisis of 2007 and into the territory that we're in right now. What can we learn about the future by examining two decades of the past? All of that's coming up next on The Big Picture as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertised with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.